The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Thursday, February 8th, 2018. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. When asked why Donald Trump would support Roy Moore but decry Al Franken, his spokesperson, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, routinely said, well, Franken admitted it, Roy Moore didn't. When asked how can the GOP keep Steve Wynn's money with the allegations against him, but demand the DNC give back all the money Harvey Weinstein gave, Republicans said, well, Steve Wynn never admitted it. Harvey Weinstein seems to have apologized. You see how it works? By admitting it, when it comes to harassing, demeaning, or in the case of Rob Porter beating women, according to accounts and photographic evidence, the key is you just don't admit it. So this gave license to reporters who attended the White House press briefing today to ask some pretty aggressive questions. Questions that might normally seem unfair. In journalism, there is a question known as the when did you stop beating your wife question. No good way to answer it. And John Gizzi of Newsmax, notably Newsmax, very conservative publication, founder of Newsmax, Chris Ruddy, a Trump surrogate. John Gizzi was asking the White House spokesman this.
Thank you, Raj. Two brief questions.
Sure.
First, can you roughly say, are there a lot of other people at the highest levels in the White House operating under a temporary security pass?
And by a lot, I mean, oh, three or four, because that would be a problem, wouldn't it? So Raj Shah, the spokesman there, you hear him saying, I can't get into that, because essentially, Gizzi wasn't asking, when did you stop beating your wife? But he was essentially asking, when are we going to learn about more wife beatings? Gizzi followed up.
The other question, very simply, are there going to be any further resignations by Friday or over the weekend?
And I'd like to know, because we've filed some professional obituaries, in fact, for all of your staff, and we want to know when to time them.
I have no personnel announcements.
And that got a little chuckle out of Raj Shah. And in the end, isn't that what holding the White House accountable for countenancing spousal abuse is all about? No, it's not. On the show today, it's a popular segment, the return thereof. It's Mike Debates Slate. Cue the sound effects. Choo-choo, choo-choo. That was me. I both said cue the sound effects and provided the sound effects. Now, in this edition of Mike Debates Slate, Slate writer Joshua Keating argued that the Iran nuclear deal has not been working out. And in fact, I didn't really tell him beforehand it was a Mike Debates Slate choo-choo segment, but he played along really well. Let's listen. If you want to cut to the core of today's issues, check out I Have to Ask. Each week on the show, Slate's resident interrogator, Isaac Chotiner, well, one of Slate's resident interrogators, talks one-on-one with newsmakers, celebrities, and cultural icons, well, one at a time, to help us better understand them and our world. Look for it every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts. I have to say that I love I Have to Ask. I don't think I've ever missed an episode, and Isaac does a great job as an interrogator and one of the residents here at Slate. What if the Iran deal was a mistake? Josh Keating, writing in Slate, that august publication Slate, writes, I supported Obama's signature foreign policy achievement. Now I think it may have made things worse. It is an argument that is well-reasoned, well-put, eminently sensible, and in my opinion, wrong. And that is why I've invited Josh Keating on for another fabulous segment of Mike Debates Slate. I don't know if you knew this was a debate segment, Josh, but it's going to be. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Did you know it was debate?
I did not, but
okay.
Looking
That's
forward
okay.
to it.
It'll be a good, challenging interview.
Sure.
So when people assess the Iran deal, even before it happened, it's a quid pro quo. The United States and the other signatories to the deal give up something and they get something. And usually the criticisms are mostly about the quo. People would say, I don't think Iran will stick to the deal. We think Iran will still pursue nuclear weapons. But your article doesn't focus on that. So lay out what your problem is with the quid part of the quid pro quo.
Yeah, like you said, my article is less about what is in the deal itself. You know, by all accounts, the deal is working. There's both U.S. and international assessments say Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons, isn't complying with the steps meant to keep it from developing one. What I'm thinking more about lately and what sort of led me to this was about the concessions that were made in order to make the deal a reality. The one I lead with was essentially the U.S. supported Saudi Arabia's bombing campaign, the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen, in large part so that Saudi Arabia would support the deal or at least not work to undermine it or object to it too loudly. That may have made sense in 2015. I think looking at the consequences of that war and the current state of crisis in Yemen, I think that it's a lot less clear that that was clearly worthwhile to support Saudi Arabia there.
Okay, let's talk about the Yemen civil war. The death toll, official estimates, 10,000. Humanitarian groups say it's a bit more than that. Now, 10,000, 12,000, 15,000 killed. That's horrible. But the three things I would say are, one, compared to Syria and also compared to, you know, other conflicts like Congo or other conflicts in the world, it's relatively small. Two, that conflict started and the bulk of the casualties weren't before the deal, but the conflict has been roiling for decades. And certainly the Houthis overthrew the government there a year or two before the deal. And three, Iran and Saudi Arabia both play a part in this. So to say that we emboldened the Iranians by giving them the funds to fund the Houthis, I mean, we're also funding the other side of that, which is the Saudis.
This wasn't explicitly stated at the time, but, you know, a number of U.S. lawmakers outside the White House, a number of members of Congress, said things like, it's important that we have to have Saudi Arabia's back, you know, so they don't think we abandon them as we negotiate this deal for Iran. Now, I would say that even Obama administration officials, as they were signing these weapons deals and providing logistical assistance to this bombing campaign, were also publicly expressing doubts about it. We saw, you know, Ash Carter, the former Secretary of Defense, saying that he thinks it was undermining the fight against al-Qaeda, that it was providing chaos that would be exploited by groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS. There were U.S. assessments that were skeptical about the degree to which the Houthis were really a proxy for Iran. I mean, clearly there's support there. But yes, you know, the conflict wasn't purely started by the United States, but I think it's the U.S. has played a strong role in it and has clearly come down on the Saudi side, despite the fact that, you know, it was pretty clear the Obama administration didn't think this was a good idea. And that doesn't even get into the humanitarian issues involved.
Right. So of all your points, I would concede that some escalation of the war in Yemen was a consequence of this deal. We don't know how much would have happened absent the deal. I definitely think that, I mean, the Quds missiles that are firing, that are landing a few feet from the, or a few meters from the Riyadh airport, are clearly provided by Iran. So that's true. It's just when weighed against the possibility of a nuclearized Iran, I'd still take that bargain. But the last big part is, you write about how the United States took its eye off of Syria, didn't forcefully intervene in Syria to prevent the chaos there because they prioritized the deal in Iran. And my problem with that is, even if they had, what do you think Syria would have looked like had President Obama said, we're going to do something about Syria?
I don't know. I mean, I think I'm pretty clear in the piece. I don't think there was a easy solution to Syria. I think and there's a possibility we could have ended up with no Iran deal and Syria in chaos. And I think that the kind of idea that there were no good options for the U.S. and Syria kind of became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Clearly, earlier in the war, there was a reluctance to act at a time when it was possible that some kind of diplomatic breakthrough could have been reached. But I do think it's true that it probably would have been impossible to get the Iran deal and some sort of political settlement in Syria that stopped the fighting. And, you know, looking back in 2018 at which of those issues, you know, the Obama administration should have prioritized, you know, I lean towards Syria just because of seeing consequences, not just for that country, but, you know, in terms of the rise of ISIS, the refugee crisis and its effect on countries, not just in the Middle East, but in the West as well. I mean, it's hard for me to say now that, any issue should have been prioritized over Syria. You know, the piece is really, you know, an argument about priorities and whether, you know, nuclear nonproliferation should always be the top priority over all other foreign policy goals.
Right. I don't think it should always be the priority. But, I mean, you put it there. Given the choice between intervening and doing something in Syria or non-nuclear Iran, you would have chosen doing something in Syria. But I would say that even if, in that alternate reality, the United States achieved a better result, and I don't know if that would be the deposing of Bashar al-Assad. I don't know if that would be not 500,000 refugees, but 100,000 refugees. I know that it would have been judged, and not entirely unfairly, as a foreign policy blunder for Obama. Because to achieve anything really militarily, I don't know, a few hundred or a thousand Americans would have died. No one would regard that as, aha, we achieved a stalemate. We prevented 500,000 refugees from flooding across the borders into Europe, because no one would have known that the alternate reality to our alternate reality, which happens to be the real reality, is 500,000 refugees flooding into Europe. So what I'm saying is that Obama, I think, correctly looked at his choices and correctly assessed that no matter what he did would be judged a failure. And it's not just judgment. I think it would have been a failure. And I think at least the Iran deal is the possibility to be a success.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree with a lot of that. I mean, I think you're right that either way might have been judged a failure. I'm not sure that we know for certain that it would have been a failure on the scale of what we saw now. I mean, I accept that this is easy to say in hindsight, and I understand fully the arguments that were made at the time. I was sympathetic to them. I'm just looking at this in hindsight as to what the priorities were, and I'm not sure I'm as comfortable as I used to be defending the choice to prioritize Iran over these other potential achievements, even if they wouldn't have looked as definitive as the Iran deal did.
Another nitpick I might have is in the article, I think you do downplay the effect of having nuclear weapons and not even using them. One point you write, nuclear weapons have done far less damage in the past 70 years than the wars in Syria and Yemen have done in the last two. Well, I would argue with that. In fact, I'm going to right now. The fact that the Soviet Union was nuclearized allowed them to do most of the damage they did. I mean, we're talking about, you know, we're not going to go through a chapter and verse, but a non-nuclearized USSR would have been far less aggressive on the international stage. And I think you have to attribute the death toll that redounds to them, at least in part, on nuclear weapons. And why wouldn't Iran one day be in that same category?
Well, you could. I mean, that cuts both ways. I mean, there's the kind of deterrence article too. That one big reason that there are fewer battlefield deaths in the past half century, and that interstate wars, you know, happen very rarely, if at all, now is because of nuclear weapons. What we see in the world now is, you know, interstate wars, like, or proxy wars, like we have in Syria. So, I'm certainly not downplaying the risks of nuclear weapons or the negative impact of them, and I'm absolutely happy Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon today. And again, what the argument was about was, what should U.S. priorities be? Should it be nonproliferation, or should it be doing what we can to sort of reduce the sectarian tensions, namely Iran and Saudi Arabia, that are driving a lot of these conflicts and a lot of instability that makes things dangerous, not just for people in that region, but for people around the world? And I'm leaning towards the latter right now.
Yeah. And let me compliment your piece by saying, first of all, I never thought the deal was a slam dunk. And I thought the downside was that it would empower and embolden Iran to be a malefactor on the world stage. I worried more about Hezbollah, and maybe we'll see that come to pass. The humanitarian impact and destabilizing impact of the war in Yemen hasn't much been accounted for. And I think your article does a good job of accounting for that.
Yeah, thanks. And I know it's not going to convince everyone, but I just hope people at the very least sort of think more critically about the foreign policy legacy of the Obama years, and you know, not just sort of defend it simply because the arguments being mounted against it by the current administration are so transparently unconvincing. You know, if we're going to think seriously, we have to take both the achievements and the trade-offs into account.
Yes, Josh Keating is a bit of a sage on international affairs for us at Slate. He is a staff writer here. His article is, "What if the Iran deal was a mistake?" Thank you, Josh.
Thanks, Mike.
And now the spiel. So there's a deal brewing in the House to fund the government for 2 years. Woohoo! Bloomberg reports a few sweeteners on the deal, some tax breaks for NASCAR, racetracks, and rum. Or as I call it, the deadbeat dad trifecta. Rum. Yes, rum. And you know what else is in the bill? Craft breweries. They benefit. They get some breaks. So all I hope is that the rum provision shows up a little bit earlier in the text of the bill than the craft brew provision because, you know, liquor before beer, you're in the clear. It is an odd piece of federal legislation that makes you attempt to recall fraternity party rhyming slang. But that's not even the story I want to focus on. What is it? Stock market down 3-4%? Nah, happens all the time this week. How about today and Ron Johnson alleges? Eh, let's really, have we not learned? Let's not bother what Ron Johnson alleges. This is what I want to talk about. Tiffany Brown from Atlanta. Tiffany Brown is an Atlanta woman with a lot of gumption, or maybe moxie, or maybe chicanery, because she got a government contract to deliver 30 million meals to storm-ravaged Puerto Rico, came up a little short. She gave them 50,000 meals, so that is less than 0.02% of her obligation. Here's the New York Times. Ms. Brown, who is adept at navigating the federal contracting system, hired a wedding caterer in Atlanta with a staff of 11 to freeze-dry wild mushrooms and rice, chicken and rice, and vegetable soup. Doing the math on the staff of 11, each person would be responsible for a little less than 2 million meals each. By the way, they freeze-dried it wrong. The ones they did do, they were all supposed to be freeze-dried together in the packet that you could boil, and it wasn't, so she even screwed up the 50,000. And I like that phrase, adept at navigating the system. I'll say, her website says, here's her website, Dr. Tiffany Brown is no stranger to hard work and putting forth a strong effort to create success. Doctor? What is she a doctor of? It turns out, sort of, she's a doctor of public policy. Where did she get her degree? From Walden University. Online college, Walden University. Call yourself a doctor. The red flags just keep on coming. Upon graduation from Walden University, where she walked during commencement from her bathroom to her foyer, she has truly impacted change as an academic and practitioner. Practitioner, Dr. Brown. Dr. Brown... Celray soda. Dr. Brown is a former 2009 write-in Atlanta mayoral candidate, right there prominently on her bio. She is a former write-in candidate. You know what qualifications you need to be a write-in candidate? You need a name. It also gets you 200 on each section of the SAT. I know that. You got to have that name. And when I say I have a name, I don't mean like she has a name in the industry. You just literally have a series of letters that the Social Security Bureau recognizes. Through determination and strong effort, she didn't get on the ballot. She did put out a press release decrying the fact that she didn't get on the ballot. And also in 2009, she put out this video, which as far as I could tell was the extent of her campaigning, where she dwelled mostly on the issue of campus safety at Clark Atlanta University.
Please vote me in. Write me in as your next mayor of Atlanta. What can I do for you? Let me tell you what I can do for you. I will make sure that there is a campus watch program with a text messaging feature.
Tiffany. Sorry. Ms. Brown. Sorry. Dr. Brown. Root beer. Dr. Brown, Atlanta is a city of 5.8 million people. We are not voting on the text messaging features at Clark University. We are also not voting for you. She did not win. If she won, her bio would say something then, write-in candidate for mayor in 2009. Everything about Tiffany Brown reeks of hustler in every sense of the word. She brags about, this is also from her website, she has held positions with the United States Government Accountability Office, the Fulton County District Attorney's Office, I don't know if that means she was once arrested, Georgia Law Center for the Homeless. All right, let's go back to the United States Government Accountability Office. What position did she hold? The GAO doesn't list anything, but it is true that the government has canceled contracts on her 5 times in the past, 4 times with the federal prison system and once with the government publishing office because she was asked to make 3,000 tote bags and she didn't follow the instructions and only printed the Marine Corps logo on one side of the bag and not both. So from that failure to make 3,000 tote bags, she got the deal to make 30 million meals. I guess she claims the tote bags were lost in shipping from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Now, the government publishing office failed to, or perhaps could not tell, the other government offices about the good doctor. And so she got paid $150 million to provide food for people in Puerto Rico. How did she do it? Well, here's a clue. She told herself it could be done. She's written 3 books, self-published, you might be shocked to learn. One is Daily Reflections of Life, a book of affirmations for the ambitious. Now look this book up. The major form of punctuation is the smiley face. I am not kidding. Here is some of chapter 1. Day 1, unstoppable. Today is about being unstoppable. I guess the government publishing office would agree. Quote, I'm a believer in positive thinking. You can manifest anything if you just believe. And there we have the secret. This woman has been influenced by the secret. We're giving government contracts to people whose only qualification is that they read the secret. Maybe twice. I don't know. I guess we got to say to the hungry Puerto Ricans, she's just not that into you. This is the age of the huckster. We have a huckster president. He's hired huckster staff. And we've outsourced our space program to entertaining huckster Elon Musk. Now, to be fair, Elon Musk might very well be the greatest visionary our age knows. Although it's also possible he's the greatest huckster who ever lived. There's little chance he's anything in between. I will not blame this particular government breakdown on Trump. I mean, it would be fair if you did. He's ultimately responsible for all of this, and he certainly doesn't care what's going on in Puerto Rico. But in the end, it's that Tiffany Brown simply believed she could achieve 130 million meals. It's not surprising that people like this exist. That she was actually given money to achieve those 130 million meals is appalling. Also these days, not surprising. And as for her mayoral efforts, Atlanta does not delineate who got what write-in votes. But in 2009, a grand total in this city of nearly 6 million people, grand total of 67 write-in votes were cast. That is for everyone, citywide. And still, her write-in candidacy is prominently mentioned on Dr. Brown's website. Although, you know, if every vote translated into 100,000 meals delivered, yeah, she'd still be more than 20 million short. And that's it for today's show. The Gist was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé. Is it true that he was seen canoodling with Mark Knopfler? You'll have to listen to Pierre Dates Members of Dire Straits, the newest segment on the show. Mary Wilson, Gist senior producer, intensely watches the Olympics, but we're going to be featuring that in an upcoming segment, Mary Denigrates Skates. Steve Lichtai is executive producer of Slate Podcast. He's the guy in charge of the fancy sound effects. Choo-choo! The Gist. Come on! You're a chimp! You're not a gibbon! You're not a howler monkey? That's a little tease from our upcoming segment, Mike Motivates Primates. Lemur Fever. Catch it. Oom-peru-da-peru-do-peru, and thanks for listening.